Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The sun has broken through briefly here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West Virginia on this Friday evening, the 12th of June. And I am, as ever, tickled pink to be with you. Come on over to the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. Join in the fun and frivolity. I got to tell you, Fridays can be a little slow getting started in the chat room. Just a few folks in there right now. Trouble and Texas Betsy, ELO, chat room den mother. Cobwebs is in there. I'm in there. Come on in if you know, there's not a lot of folks in the pool. If you've never jumped in before, this is a good time to start. This is Friday. It is that day when usually we take ourselves out to the front porch for a little, as John Fox notes in the intro, cussin' and discussin'. Grab a rocking chair. Take a swig from the jug if you want, with sweet cider too if you want. We're going to start the program this evening with a little conversation regarding a new book out. Something that is near and dear to my heart. It is a collection of a series of essays by Steve Early. The name of the book is Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. It is from Monthly Review Press, monthlyreview.org. It is available most anywhere you might want to lay your hands upon it. Mr. Early himself, Steve, has been involved with the labor movement for many, many years. He's been an organizer with the Communications Workers of America. He's been a strike strategist. He has been a labor educator and a lawyer as well. He has been published in a number of various and sundry different periodicals and journals: The Nation, New Politics, Counterpunch, The Progressive, American Prospect, Working USA, New Labor Forum, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe. The list is by far not exhaustive. It goes on considerably. This collection of essays, however, covers the wide range of dilemmas, problems, issues that face modern organized labor on a wide variety of fronts. Everything from organization to how how unions function from both a macro to a micro level. Issues of race and gender. Issues of touching upon immigrants. And this is all information drawn from more than 30 years' experience. So, with what is taking place in the labor movement today, especially something as critical as the Employee Free Choice Act (EFCA), it strikes me that Steve Early will be a valid commentator and a valued commentator on all of these issues. Many and most of which are contained, and it's a darn good read too. This is not only interesting and thought-provoking, but pleasurable to spend time with, especially if you think like I do that it's the working class that carries the well-to-do, and not, as so often is the case, argued on right-wing hate radio, the other way around, that somehow or another a handful of filthy rich are carrying all our dead butts. No. We know who's got the nation on our on their backs every blessed day. So welcome to the program, Steve Early.
Steve, great to be here, Bob.
Oh, thank you for joining us. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. And let me just start by thanking you for the years that you have put into the labor movement and the thought that you put into what makes a better labor movement.
Well, it was a privilege to work for many years with members of many different unions, including the United Mine Workers. Got my start in the labor movement as a staffer for the UMW and spent much time in the mid-70s in the great state of West Virginia. And
did you really?
I did, yes.
The UMW, UMWA is an organization near and dear to my heart, my being the son, grandson, and great-grandson of UMWA miners. I never had that experience myself. They tried to make sure that I didn't, if you know what I mean. The UMWA has so many good things going for it, but like so many unions, there are obstacles that face it that seem at times almost insurmountable. Steve, what is the greatest single issue in your estimation for organized labor today?
Well, I think you touched on it, Bob, in the introduction. For decades now, union membership, including in the coal industry, has been declining in the private sector. Employers of all types have become much more aggressive in making it difficult, if not impossible, for workers to exercise their right under federal law to form or join a union and negotiate a union contract. And fortunately, we now have an opportunity, the first time in 30 years, to try to enact some new legislation at the federal level, the Employee Free Choice Act, which you mentioned, which would strengthen considerably the original protections for organizing and bargaining that were first enacted in 1935 as the Wagner Act during the depths of the Great Depression.
And doesn't the Employee Free Choice Act, and I don't want this conversation just to be about EFCA, but doesn't the Employee Free Choice Act in many ways simply reaffirm a lot of Wagner?
It does. When workers originally organized in the late 1930s, the most common method that they used was signing union cards by the tens of thousands in the steel industry and the coal mines and the auto plants. Then when a majority of the workers had signed up, they made a demand for union recognition and sometimes had to back that up by striking. But that's how they brought major employers to the table and were able to negotiate the first contracts that later provide several generations of coal miners, auto workers, steel workers with a decent standard of living and health coverage and a pension. And unfortunately, that system for union representation and certification has broken down over the last 70-odd years. And this attempt in Congress today, hopefully with the backing of the Obama administration, is a long overdue effort to get that machinery working again.
I think there is some frustration, Steve, in you mentioned the Obama administration and Congress. A lot of the frustration that I hear in the course and scope of what I do is such that it seems like there is a I don't know exactly how to put it, but some of the push behind EFCA in the Congress is rather lukewarm, and that the Democratic majority does not enjoy the full support of its membership. How do you clear a hurdle like that with somebody like Ben Nelson or the senator from Arkansas, Blanche Lincoln, people like that? How do you get over that hump when it's inside your own party?
Well, I think you've definitely named a couple of the right names in terms of potential backsliders in terms of their senatorial support for passage of labor law reform. There's been a very well-funded, very aggressive employer campaign against the Employee Free Choice Act. It is having an impact. The Senate, as we know, operates under undemocratic rules. You can't pass legislation or get it through the Senate with a simple majority. You have to have a supermajority of 60 votes to shut off any opposition filibuster. We're not quite there yet. Need one more senator to get seated, and then there is the problem you mentioned of some beginning to have second thoughts, inspired by heavy corporate lobbying. I think we need to look at this in historical terms. In the depths of the Great Depression, what was it that helped millions of people improve their standard of living, increase their purchasing power without any great expenditure of taxpayer money? It was passage of the National Labor Relations Act, which gave them the right to organize and bargain and improve their wages and benefits and working conditions through self-help, through the unionization process. And I think we need a similar economic stimulus approach today for the millions of workers who have already been badly battered by this great recession that we're still suffering in.
Well, there are a couple of issues that arise from what you just said, Steve. One of them is the question, I suppose, primarily, having had such a long and good relationship between the Democratic Party and organized labor, is there the possibility out there that some people in the party have begun to take labor for granted?
I think that's very definitely a risk, and the fact that this important legislation was not part of the economic stimulus package that was rushed through as the first order of business of the Obama administration is not a good sign, because the more it gets shuffled off into and pigeonholed in the category of special interest legislation, a favor for big labor, which, as we know, isn't big anymore, the less chance it has of passage. So I think, as one union member put it to me the other day, the way that people need to support the president they helped elect is to stand behind him so he stops taking any more backward steps on this legislation and other important legislation, and build the grassroots movement for passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, because it's going to take continued rank-and-file agitation and activity to overcome the corporate and conservative Republican and conservative Democrat opposition.
What about the effect of media on organized labor? Part and parcel of the whole nightmare with Detroit has been an ongoing and seemingly, well, shameless effort on the part of what I call the for-profit media, Steve, to demonize working people. How much has that, and it's not a brand new isolated incident, it's something that's been going on for years and years and years. How much of the media's efforts to marginalize labor has played a part in the transformation into what you call, you know, small labor now?
Well, certainly the big newspaper chains are in many cases not terribly union friendly themselves. My union alma mater, the Communication Workers, includes the Newspaper Guild, and our Newspaper Guild members have had many battles with major media conglomerates, and you see their resistance to the idea that workers should have rights reflected not just on their editorial pages and in their choice of editorial columnists, but certainly also in their own labor relations policies and strategies. So this is one of the reasons why the labor movement has been trying to get the word out about the need for labor law reform through its own lower budget advertising activity and largely through word of mouth, through the 16 million union members talking to their friends, neighbors, community groups, student organizations, churches, anyone who might be interested in thinking of workers' rights as a civil right, as a human right, and thinking of collective bargaining as something that is good for the whole community, not just union members and their families themselves.
You have done an excellent job, in particular, one of the essays that I read in your book, Not Your Father's Union Movement. What is there a single sea change, Steve, from what you refer to as your father's union movement to the union movement today? And what are the primary differences between the two?
Well, I think in the past, when unions had more clout just based on their own size or industry position, you know, think of our brothers and sisters in the UMW in days past, in the days of John L. Lewis, when the union was a major force. There was a tendency back then not to reach out and build alliances and coalitions with other elements of the community. And I think as part of the humbling process of labor facing some setbacks in recent decades and getting smaller, we now see a much greater commitment on the part of many unions to finding partners and allies, finding a way to work with other members of the public around issues of common interest. For example, in West Virginia, this proposed sale of the all the landline phone system in the state, Verizon wanting to dump its West Virginia customers and sell to a company that's going to provide much poorer service, probably be a poorer unionized employer. This is the kind of fight where union members themselves can't win, but if they enlist ratepayers, if they enlist small businessmen, if they enlist political allies, there's a possibility of a win-win for both labor and consumers.
Is there, you mentioned John L. Lewis, and of course we can go on the Ruther brothers. Those men were giants of labor, and they did wield considerable power. Has there been a is there a winnowing of talent, or is it just a matter of the weakened state of organized labor now that that we don't see those giants striding the earth, as it were?
Well, partly it is just the shrinkage in numbers and the scale of unions as institutions that affect the lives of as many people as they did during the middle of the last century. But there are still some very strong, competent, visionary leaders. Rich Trumka, who, as you know, was the president of the United Mine Workers and has served for the last 15 years or so as secretary-treasurer of the AFL-CIO, appears to be in line to succeed John Sweeney as president of the national AFL-CIO. Rich, certainly as the leader of the mine workers in strike situations like the Great Pittston Struggle, has shown a lot of creativity, a lot of imagination, a lot of willingness to think outside the box, and I think we need more of that.
One of the things that I have seen recently is this nascent, you talk about these alliances, Steve, this nascent alliance represented, for instance, by the Blue-Green Alliance between labor and the environmental movement. Is that the kind of thing that you're describing? Is do those seemingly disparate elements of activism, is there a real chance of a meeting in the middle with organizations like that?
I think so, and it's a very positive development. The union that's taking the lead in it is Pittsburgh-based. The United Steelworkers has many members in West Virginia as well. Certainly we know that there's a long history of tensions often between environmentalists, blue-collar workers in a variety of industries, and their unions. It's played out historically in West Virginia in the conflict and tensions between strip mine operators, their employees, sometimes the union, and communities and environmentalists trying to, you know, prevent the state from being destroyed and on tops being leveled. What's driving the coalition that you just described today is this understanding that there is such a thing as global warming. It's going to affect everybody, and that there are solutions to some of the problems of what we produce and how we produce it and what impact it has on the environment that could be common ground for both workers and environmentalists and other citizens. And that if the environmental movement teams up with the labor movement, jobs can be preserved, new jobs can be created, and they don't have to be further victims here if the corporations come up with their own ways of dealing with global warming, which won't necessarily be environmental friendly or worker friendly.
Well, and I'm rather intimately associated with one of those efforts. The Coal River Wind Project down in southern West Virginia is predicated on the notion that we want to create a wind farm where they would instead be desirous of blowing up the mountains. Of course, Massey Energy is practically wholly, well, not entirely, but nearly entirely, non-union corporation, and that project is predicated on the notion that the jobs that we would bring are guaranteed to be good union jobs, both in the construction phase and in the maintenance phase. Do you get a sense of any more of that kind of so-called outside the box thinking beyond, say, the steel workers and the Blue-Green Alliance? Is there a growing groundswell for that kind of thing?
Oh, definitely. I think even some of the building trade unions, which traditionally, rightly or wrongly, have been identified as being more conservative elements of organized labor, have realized that the kind of retrofitting of buildings that needs to go on to conserve energy can be a source of job creation. And as you just indicated, the key here is these are going to be low-wage jobs done by non-union contractors, taking, in some cases, our own tax dollars to do the work, or are we going to have some minimum labor standards and protect workers' rights and provide people with good union jobs doing socially useful, environmentally friendly work? And there's a lot of work to be done, and I think more unions are realizing that and are forming a pretty potent lobbying coalition at the state level in many states and in Washington to get beyond this traditional pitting of workers against environmentalists.
Now, we've mentioned, Steve, some of the traditional big player unions. We've mentioned the UAW, the UMWA, the steel workers, the building trades. What about the growing movement inside the service sector? The SEIU, for instance, has become one of the largest, if not the largest, single the collective bargaining unit in the country. Do they have the same kind of potential to change the dynamic in the country that the big industrial unions once enjoyed?
Well, SEIU certainly, has been doing very good work in a number of states, raising the floor and enabling some of the poorest, most mistreated, most exploited workers, doing workers, janitors and home care workers and nursing home workers to get better conditions for themselves and decent pay and benefits and union contracts. Some of this work actually needs to go on not just in the service sector but in the public sector as well, in states which do not really have full collective bargaining or anything close to it, like West Virginia for public employees. Some great work has been done in West Virginia and in North Carolina and other states like that by the United Electrical Workers, traditionally associated with manufacturing, but through its local 170 in West Virginia has become, I think, a very effective voice for state workers in dealing with the governor and the legislature and trying to, again, defend both the jobs of state workers and the important services they provide to many disadvantaged people in the state, in state hospitals and other programs.
And we see, of course, in many one of the few benefits to working in state government here in West Virginia, and of course this program going all over the world in other states as well, is that you take the job working for the state because at least there's some sort of a pension and benefits. Now we're seeing that sort of slide away as well. Can organizations like the electrical workers you mentioned or Ask Me, can they play a realistic role not only in stopping that retrograde motion, Steve, but also making worker state governmental workers that sort of endeavor more secure?
Well, certainly it's a difficult challenge at the moment because workers in the public sector everywhere are faced with pay cuts, cuts in their benefit coverage and furloughs as a response to the state budget crises, which vary in intensity from state to state. But I think groups like UE Local 170 and similar state worker organizations in other states as part of a larger coalition of people working for fair taxation and effective provision of needed state services can make a difference, can make our states a better place to live. And for workers, even when you're negotiating backward steps, even if givebacks have to be negotiated, even if temporary pay cut or pay freeze is necessary in some employment situation, having a voice and being able to negotiate that as opposed to the employer simply deciding what's going to be taken away and for how long is a very big difference. So I think it's very important for people both in the public sector and the private sector to have full collective bargaining rights, and that will take some legislative changes in West Virginia, and just as we need the Employee Free Choice Act enacted by Congress in Washington.
And, in both the public and the private sector, we've seen this this sort of anti-worker policy grow and seem to flourish. The budget issues in governmental entities, Are all of the budget crises, or most of them, majority of them, are these? Is this a case of the Bush chickens coming home to roost after 8 years of those phony baloney tax cuts, paupering and beggaring state governments and county governments?
Certainly, the current fiscal crisis of a number of states is a product of the Wall Street meltdown. That's obviously affected adversely many public employee pension plans around the country. You have to say that if the United States had, after 2003, decided not to spend what's now approaching nearly $1 trillion on its military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, there certainly would have been a lot more tax dollars available throughout the country to provide decent public services for middle-income people, for poor people, for older people. I think it's a question really of our overall economic priorities, and hopefully the new administration, when it gets around to it, will be taking a closer look at the degree to which military spending has deprived millions of people in this country of a decent standard of living here at home.
Now, one of the essays in this, and let me just, it is a magnificent book. You bring the sense of historical perspective that you bring, you know, running from the 1930s into the present, is quite stunning. And you've got a chapter in here called Afterthoughts on Sweeney, talking about, and we mentioned him, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney. Within the last couple of years, there was a significant parting of the ways between he and Andy Stern, both of them rising out of the ranks of the SEIU. How much damage did that do overall to the labor movement, that split that resulted in Change to Win and AFL-CIO?
Well, this emergence of a separate labor federation in 2005, composed of seven former AFL-CIO unions, I think didn't have as much damage short-term as some people feared at the time, and there is a process that's been going underway, been underway since last winter to try to re-knit the AFL-CIO and its Change to Win defectors, and possibly even involve the National Education Association, the largest teachers union, in a new umbrella organization of labor federations and unions that would provide a more coordinated labor lobbying effort in Washington, and that may actually bear fruit over the next couple of months. I think there are some other internal conflicts within the labor movement at the moment that have been triggered by Brother Stern, the president of the service employees, that have not been helpful, that have been, in fact, a major distraction from the campaign for labor law reform and health care reform. And a little less of that at the moment would be quite helpful.
Keeping one's eye on the ball, then?
Very definitely. I mean, I think when we lose a sense that unions are part of a labor movement and people start to operate them like small or bigger businesses in competition with other businesses, that's not what the founders of the labor movement 100 or more years ago had in mind.
That's certainly not what Big Bill Haywood was talking about, is it?
not at all. And so I've always in my work tried to de-emphasize the barriers and the obstacles to cooperation between members of different unions, and to promote kind of cross-union networking and rank-and-file unity, because what we need is a workers' movement more than a collection of business unions. We're never going to achieve what we need to for the vast working-class majority in this country with unions squabbling with each other and competing with each other and undercutting each other. It's kind of undercuts the very notion of labor solidarity.
We mentioned media a little bit ago, and of course, me being part of that, it's near and dear to my heart. What do you get a sense anywhere in your travels, anywhere in your studies or your work, Steve? Do you get a sense that based on, you know, what we were talking about earlier, some of the vilification that the for-profit media have done to organized labor? Do you get a sense that anyone in labor understands that there is a new era out here, and that are there any unions that you think more than others, not asking for any favoritism here, have a handle on the import of leveraging, you know, the internet, blogs, the Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, whatever, do any of them have a better sense of that than another?
That's a very good question. Yes, some do, and to the extent that unions, which unfortunately at this point three-quarters of their membership are over the age of 35, which may explain why some of them are less technologically savvy than other institutions. But to the extent they're tapping into their younger members, these are the new medium of means of communication. You just listed several of them. So I think the savvier unions are becoming more effective in their use of the Internet, their use of blogs, their use of websites. And, you know, as I go around the country, I'm really impressed by the network of labor-oriented, populist-themed radio shows like yours. There's quite a few of them out there. They do provide a counterweight to what you accurately described earlier as right-wing hate radio. And there's a wonderful institution called Workers Independent News based in Madison, Wisconsin, that is trying to provide more pro-labor content for radio around the country. So I think developing these alternative media outlets is incredibly important, and unions should be doing more financially to support them. Not as mouthpieces for their own institutional positions or propaganda, but as free space and forums for the kind of alternative ideas that we don't get much of in the mainstream media.
Well, obviously, I agree with that 100%. And we've been, and just by the way, we've been running WINS for literally years. They do tremendous work. Alongside employee free choice, Steve. I don't think you can discuss the future of labor in America without discussing the issue of how we treat our immigrant labor force. What do you see as the future where undocumented workers, where immigrant workers are concerned? And I know there's a from time to time, you'll even hear people in the labor movement say, well, you know, they drive wages down. That seems like a tremendous organizing base. How do you reach, are there efforts, serious efforts, to reach the immigrant labor community, the undocumented community? Because even an undocumented, alien has a right to join a union, I understand.
Well, somewhat watered down, right, unfortunately. But this is an area where I think there's been progress in terms of union policies and positions. Certainly over the last 10 to 15 years, a range of unions, the hotel workers, the service employees, which we've discussed, and even some building trade unions like the laborers and the carpenters have become much more sensitive to the problems of the 12 million foreign-born undocumented workers. And I think the position that the unions have developed is contrary to the popular conception. It's not that workers are depressing wages. It's unscrupulous employers who are doing that, and that the reliance on employers to police workplaces and not hire workers who don't have papers, it's a failed system. And we need immigration reform that legalizes those folks who've been in the country for many years, been contributing to the economy, working hard, raising families here, and we need to give them full rights at work so they can become union members, and we need to enforce labor laws so that there's not an incentive, which there is right now, a tremendous incentive in many industries for employers to hire the most vulnerable, to hire people without papers, and then deprive them of their rights, not pay them the minimum wage, not make Social Security contributions for them or pension payments, not provide them with workers' compensation coverage or unemployment benefits when they're laid off. When you have a huge, disposable, exploitable workforce, everyone else is at risk. And that's not the fault of the workers who've been forced to leave their home countries to come here for a better life. That's the fault of the employers who are exploiting them in the fashion that I just described.
You know, there's, I know how very busy you are, and I'll try not to take up too much more of your time, Steve, but it seems that one answer leads to another question, another sector. The high-tech sector, it doesn't get a lot of the press or the time that it deserves, but what about efforts to organize inside places like Microsoft?
Well, my old union, the communication workers, actually was very involved in supporting and is still supporting what are called non-majority unions, non-traditional worker organizations inside both Microsoft and IBM. And the kinds of workers who are getting involved in these groups are tend to be from technical and professional backgrounds, software people, engineers, field engineers, some factory workers in IBM production facilities. And even though they don't have a union in a traditional sense, they don't have a contract or collective bargaining rights, they have been able to organize and agitate and lobby around issues affecting workers in both companies. At Microsoft, the big issue was long-term temporary employment of software engineers, where you have a kind of two-tier workforce, with the second tier being what are called permatemps, where people can work for the company as long as 4, 5, 6 years, but basically still hired through a temporary agency and denied full benefit coverage from one of the most profitable high-tech companies in the nation. At IBM, you know, our alliance at IBM Group has lobbied against outsourcing of jobs, has been very vocal at shareholder meetings, and has challenged the company about its health and safety practices in some of its chip-making plants.
And that's the third prong of, I think, my guess is the trident that faces organized labor today, and you address it in the book as well, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all the free trade agreements. Going back as far as the Clinton administration, organized labor got free trade rammed down its throat despite the fact that organized labor predicted correctly what the outcome would be. Do you get any sense that anyone out there is looking back and going, hey, they were right, besides members of organized labor? Is there still any starch left in the fight against advancing these things? You know, on the campaign trail, Steve, we had the big kerfuffle over Hillary and Barack Obama and whether or not somebody said something to Canada about renegotiating NAFTA, and that's all just, you know, crickets now, not on the radar. What is the current state and the future?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There were some mea culpas on the part of some of the major Democratic Party contenders for the nomination last year about the job losses and other negative effects that had been predicted by critics of free trade back when NAFTA and the World Trade Organization agreement was adopted, and trade agreements with China were fast-tracked through the Congress. Clearly, the Obama administration has not made a priority of revisiting the North American Free Trade Agreement or any of the existing ones. Where I think labor and free trade critics have had the most impact is holding up and so far blocking the extension of this approach to bilateral agreements with companies like countries like Colombia, where they have a terrible record of human rights violations, workers' rights violations, and any U.S. Colombia free trade agreement is certainly going to strengthen the hand of those forces down there and employer interests here, who have a very poor record of mistreating workers. So I think it's something the labor movement is going to probably have to address later on in the Obama administration, but the initial campaign promises to kind of revisit, reopen negotiations, attach stronger labor and environmental protections, I think have been a casualty of the economic crisis and the administration attempts to respond to that.
Well, as we go forward with things like the National Rail Initiative and as we talk about health care and all of, the green issues, the most critical issues of our day, Steve. Do you see, you know, I love the title, embedded with organized labor. Based on your embedding, is labor ready to face these challenges? Is there, for instance, with healthcare, is anyone out there talking, as we have argued here, about the fact that if you really want to solve the healthcare crisis, one of the simplest things to do is to pass EFCA?
That would certainly help, because people would then have the ability to bargain about their medical benefit coverage. I think the danger in the area of healthcare reform is the backpedaling clearly that the administration has been doing away from serious consideration of what's called a single-payer system, real national health insurance that covers everybody, that takes the employers and the private insurance companies out of the picture. Even if we are not strong enough to achieve that objective at this point, we very definitely need a public plan as part of any compromise legislation that might emerge. And I think the wing of the labor movement that's argued long and hard and is continuing to agitate and lobby for a Canadian-style Medicare for All program has been doing great work and needs to continue that fight, because we've had about 9 to 10 million people who've lost their job-based insurance coverage over the last 16 months. 4 to 5 million of them are now part of that group of 45 to 50 million people who don't have insurance coverage. And the idea that a long-term solution to that problem is going to be to shovel money in the directions of private insurers and let the employers continue to have the kind of power they do over benefit plans and what's covered and what's not and how much workers pay for them, it's not real reform, and it's not anything more than a Band-Aid. So if that's what we end up with Obama short-term, that's not really a very favorable solution for most of the people who've been really hurt as a result of the breakdown of the system of job-based private insurance coverage in this country.
It will certainly bear watching, and frankly, my eye has become rather jaundiced over the years, I'm afraid. I happened to be in a room on the day after the inauguration, Steve, where I heard Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid promise the assembled progressive media types that, and this was the quote, "We will have a card check bill by summer." I was disturbed by that because the linguistic reduction of employee free choice to "it's a card check bill" seems to be playing into the hands of the right wing. But also, I was a little bit dismayed because that was January, and I kind of figured that this is what it would look like in June. Last I checked, this is summer, and still no card check bill. Are you aware of any coming efforts? I know organized labor is trying so hard to highlight this, but it seems like they're hollering, and everybody in the Democratic Party has seemingly gone deaf.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The initial projections and expectations have not been met. There have been some closed-door meetings, certainly in the last couple of weeks, to discuss possible compromises. But I think the way the issue, as you point out, has been framed lately with the help of its corporate foes is not helpful. I mean, the real issue isn't how workers gain union recognition, whether it's through signing cards or voting in a supposedly secret ballot election that in most workplace contexts isn't very secret. And that's all a focus on process. We really need to refocus on the outcome, the goal, which is collective bargaining, empowering people at work, giving them a voice. Just as during the Great Depression, people got a new voice under the Wagner Act and were able to use it to form unions and improve their lives, we need that mechanism really restored and revitalized today for the purposes of economic recovery, not payback to unions as supporters of the Democratic Party, but as part of economic stimulus, which the original package does not seem to have kicked in with the effect that the Obama administration hoped. There's still millions of people without health insurance, without jobs, and in pretty bad shape. So this additional measure needs to be passed, and I think by reattaching it to the concept of economic stimulus, labor would have a better chance of success. And it's definitely going to have to keep the pressure on a number of key senators who are definitely backpedaling and watering down their earlier professions of support for labor law reform.
Well, I appreciate all the time you've spent with us this evening, Steve. Let me ask you this. I assume that the book is available through all the usual suspects, Amazon, Powell's, and the like.
I would highly recommend Powell's. It's a unionized bookstore in Portland. Amazon is great, but it's non-union and has been very aggressive in fighting unions. Powell's, on the other hand, is one of the rare independent unionized bookstores in the country, and also you can order books online just as easily from them. So,
good deal. Well,
look,
I hope
for the union label.
Exactly. I hope folks will pick up a copy of this, because it's a compendium of It's a labor history book, and you have done a brilliant job pulling these essays together. Steve Early, thank you very much for your time, and I wish you the very best, and I thank you for everything you're doing in the fight.
Well, thank you, Bob. Great conversation, and I really appreciate the chance to be on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Steve Early, author of Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home, published by Monthly Review Press and monthlyreview.org. And I echo Steve's encouragement that you get a copy from Powell's Books. And if we don't have a link to Powell's up in the on the website, and I apologize for my ignorance, if we don't have one, I bet you we'll find one or set up one of those one way or another. This is... If you get hold of this, and you care about what labor is and labor does, you will read this eagerly, and you will find yourself finding it, as I did, difficult to put down. There's a quote from an anonymous delegate at the 1997 AFL-CIO convention, from the American Federation of Teachers, as quoted in the New York Times. And it speaks to one of the most fundamental problems inside organized labor, and it's one of those quotes that makes my skin crawl because of the idea that it's coming from a union member. Again, we're talking about 12 years ago, but the quote is this: "Don't they realize if they really push this organizing, the labor movement is going to wind up being a movement of strawberry pickers and chicken pluckers?" Does that do to you what it does to me? Because that just makes me a little bit sick. The very nature of... There is no union out there. And you know what? I include the Major League Baseball Players Association in this, because of any or the NFL Players Association, because if there are rich unions out there, those two are the poster children for them. It's hard to think about singing Solidarity Forever, standing on a picket line with a shortstop who makes, you know, $42 million a year. You get my meaning. But there is not a union in this country that was not born in the dire and grinding horrors of poverty. There is not a bricklayer. There is not a ball player. There is not a sheet metal worker, nor a communications worker. There is not a single member of any union in this country who does not owe a profound debt of gratitude to people who were broke as the Ten Commandments and poor as Job's turkey, who, despite everything allayed and arrayed against them, allied and arrayed against them, I suppose, despite all that, took up the banner and put their feet on the street. And to the extent that elitism still exists from that 1990s, and that's, you know, it can't be argued to be characteristic, and I'm not, but it is something to be stamped out. I'm not talking about stamping out anybody's free speech or anybody's ideas, but the idea that one working person is better than another working person is repulsive to the whole idea of organized labor. Because, see, I do still kind of, yeah, no kind of about it. One big union, baby. One big union. If Bill Haywood had gotten his vision, well, odds are we would never heard the name. Let me start. Had Big Bill Haywood gotten his vision, we would never have heard the names of Warren Gamaliel Harding, Calvin Coolidge, Herbert Hoover, maybe Eisenhower. But certainly not Dick Nixon. God knows, not Gerald Ford, nor Ronald Reagan, nor George H.W. Bush, nor horrifyingly George W. Bush. Because the one thing that every one of those doughy, pasty-faced, old, hateful white men have in common is the fact that each one of them has thought no more of a working American than someone thinks of a cockroach scurrying across the floor. And had the IWW succeeded, those vile men never would have had a chance. You know, it's worth remembering that the highest percentage of union membership in this country came in the Eisenhower administration with a Republican Congress and a Republican president. Because the Wagner Act still had some starch in it. People were still able to organize. And with a Republican Congress and a Republican president, people understood in the days before massive electronic media and before the days of the 24-hour constant drumbeat news cycle owned by right-wing corporations, people understood that their only chance against a stacked deck like that was in solidarity and standing together. And if anything, that's the shortcoming of labor in the George W. Bush administration. Because in the George W. Bush administration, labor had its best ever argument for union membership. And to an extent, union membership did grow, but not by the extent that it needs to grow. But I, of course, am preaching to the choir, and I recognize that. So now we go forward, and no, it's not the George W. Bush administration we have to worry about. It's Harry Reid. Harry Effin Reid. It's Ben Nelson, Blanche Lincoln, David Pryor, and newly minted Democrat Arlen Specter. You know, honest to God, I think I would trust Phil Specter as a Democrat more than I would Arlen Specter. I just would. But you understand that corporate America gets the idea that, or actually they created the idea. It's all about the money. If there aren't any unions, they get to keep more money. If there aren't any unions, they get to keep more power. What has all of that power done for corporate America? Well, it has certainly enriched some bottom lines. But Jesus criminy! This is 2009, and guess what? General Motors just died! General Motors! And I don't care what Lou Dobbs says or any of the right-wing goober heads out there. Unions didn't kill it. Silk-suited executives with the foresight of a plat of peat moss killed General Motors and Chrysler. Union workers, hey, it's what they tell us to build. We've given and we've given. Yeah, we tend to forget. It's not a brand new problem. I remember years ago talking about what General Motors was doing to the organized labor workforce inside its little captive subsidiary, Delphi. You remember Delphi? Do you remember the deal with the devil that union workers were forced to make? When General Motors said, listen, we're either going to shut down altogether, or your $27 an hour job is going to turn into a $9 an hour job. What kind of a choice is that? That's not a choice. And the UAW didn't do that to Delphi. Delphi's management did that to Delphi. Shipping jobs to Mexico under NAFTA did that to Delphi. But it's damn difficult to find anywhere in the for-profit media that will say those same things. And that's because the for-profit media are run by the same kinds of corporations that make the same kinds of stupid decisions that industrial giants have been making. Wow, that's a... Hey, look, the rest of the world's buying cars that don't burn as much gasoline. See if you can get that new Grand Gargantua down to 6 miles a gallon, would you, boys? Let's put a 19.8-liter V56 engine in it, and we'll really rake in the dough. And the union says, well, if that's what we got to build, that's what we got to build. But it's the union's fault. Working people's fault. Yeah, it's all because we didn't go shopping enough after September 11, 2001, right? It's all because we didn't jack up the credit cards more after September 11th, 2001. Yeah, it's working people's fault. But you understand this. You get this. Ultimately, the question is how you get this information to the people who don't. How do you, for instance, okay, you know where he's going. Yeah, I am. For instance, a guy drops out of high school, 16 years old in West Virginia, and he gets himself a job blowing up people's home country. And in exchange for blowing up people's communities, he's given a tidy salary. And as long as the check clears, he's happy about it, because odds are he doesn't live around what he's doing. If anybody ever whispers union around him, somebody from Massey is there to say, you don't need no union, here's some more money. Hey, look at that 401k over there, you're going to be rich by the time you're 50. You can quit all this. That 401k ain't worth much anymore. But as long as the check clears, he's happy. And he says things like, well, the union's day is past. I got good wages. I got some health care. I don't need no union. And he never thinks about the morality or immorality of what he does. He never tries to make it a more moral job, a more ethical job. He just does, you know, it's that compartmentalized mindset that we were discussing. And just as, and this is part and parcel of why it's so hard to organize a union under the law as it currently exists, just as for every enslaved human being who followed the drinking gourd before the Civil War, who took a ride on the Underground Railroad, who sought freedom in the North and across the Canadian border. Just like, for every one of those, there were probably 100 or 1,000 who said, no, I'm staying on the place. Marsh gives me 3 hots and a cot, and I ain't going nowhere. So too the mountain remover. There are some who have come away from that. Our good friend Ed Wiley, for instance, worked on a mountain removal job, and he stepped away from it one day when he realized that he was messing with things beyond anything that he should be allowed to mess with, that he was, in fact, ruining his granddaughter's future, and he stepped away from it. And he followed the drinking gourd, and he went on that Underground Railroad ride, and he took the ride to freedom. And he's free now, and he's fighting. But for every one Ed Wiley, there are 1,000, 5,000 who say, no, I ain't leaving. Marsh Blankenship gives me $50,000 a year to screw the place I live. I'm going to keep screwing. And ultimately the question is, and see, this is not how you organize that group. This is just us talking. The question is, how do you get through? How do you get through and explain to someone that when they buy into right-wing lies, they're going to take away your secret ballot? You know, that's one of the failures of the argument about EFCA. Because we've got an argument, too, that's every bit as compelling. When the right wing's, they're going to take away your secret ballot. Well, the response is, well, guess what? You right-wing bastards already took away our First Amendment right to freedom of association. Because if we had freedom of association under the First Amendment, we'd have a union yesterday. But we don't. So we don't. So shut the hell up about the secret ballot, because it's a lie in the first place. But the First Amendment freedom of association, no, sunshine, that's no lie. That is the truth. So long as men and women who work for a living can't organize as they wish to and join into collective bargaining units on nothing more than their own desire. So long as they can't do that, the First Amendment is a dead letter to them. Isn't it? Yeah. Now, the right wing and the corporate leaders and everything, they have their First Amendment rights. They have their First Amendment right to freedom of association. The American Medical Association, the world's largest union, most powerful union, the American Medical Association, has been going hammer and tongs at the idea of a public option in the health care debate. Because they, in exercising their freedom of association, have declared that you don't deserve to be able to go to the doctor when you're sick and not worry about being financially ruined by it. Their freedom of association is alive and well. Yours ain't. There's them that work and them that don't. We work. They don't. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is Activist Radio. Your calls are always welcome. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Your calls are always welcome at the horn.
Big ball screen. Can't you hear me when I call? Big ball of Spain.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health is out with a new report that finds workers are still dying on the job in unacceptable numbers. Joe Shufro is executive director of the committee.
It essentially finds that workers are being killed on the job here in New York, as in other parts of the country, as a result of the failure of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to enforce the law, and that's not because the agency is not doing its job, it's that they don't have enough resources.
The report finds that 69% of the workplace injuries in New York City involved non-union workers. The rate of workplace fatalities in New York City fell in 2007, but increased in the rest of New York State. The report says the number of OSHA inspectors is insufficient to protect the health and safety of workers. The AFL-CIO says the American Health Choices Act, which got a Senate hearing Thursday, demonstrates the commitment of Senator Ted Kennedy and the Democratic Senate leadership to comprehensive reform. The Labor Federation says the legislation will improve quality and efficiency of care while constraining costs and will allow Americans to choose to maintain their current insurance if they're satisfied with it. The Service Employees International Union has scored a second major win in Massachusetts. Jesse Russell reports.
On the heels of a victory in April, which saw the Service Employees International Union organize 800 workers at St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Brighton, Massachusetts, the labor union can now notch a second healthcare facility on its belt. Workers at Caritas Kearney Hospital in Dorchester, Massachusetts, voted in favor of joining the SEIU this month, with 79% of the voting workers seeking representation. Both the Dorchester and Brighton facilities are owned by Caritas Christi Healthcare. St. Elizabeth's was the first hospital in the Boston region to accept union representation in more than a decade. The union is working to organize more hospitals in the hub and expects more victories before the year is out. The union has benefited from a positive relationship with the hospital chain, as it signed an agreement that promised free and fair elections throughout the system. The workers will be represented in contract negotiations by SEIU Local 1199. Here is today's economic report. A new survey suggests most workers get along with bosses and colleagues. The survey from Account Temps found that 80% of those surveyed had a good relationship with supervisors. 95% of those surveyed claimed to work well with their coworkers. Only 2% of those surveyed said they had a poor working relationship with their boss.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Man, when the chickens come home to roost, they come with their claws out. What I mean by that? Well, 15 past the hour, by the way. That's the obligatory radio guy time check. What I mean by that, did you hear the story in Wynn's news there? Because OSHA, the occupational self... professional broadcaster, my rear end. Because OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration agency, because OSHA does not have adequate inspectors, more workers are dying from more injuries and incidents that could otherwise have been prevented. Got that? It's really one of those, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, for want of the shoe, the horse was lost, for want of the kind of things. Add that to the list, why don't you? Because there are not adequate inspectors in the United States Department of Agriculture, our food supply is at greater risk than it has ever been in our lifetimes. Because the EPA and the Department of Interior are understaffed, our environment, our homes, and our communities are under greater risk than they have ever been in our lifetimes. How did that happen? Where did that come from? There are always going to be budget issues within any given governmental agency. That's the nature of our unwieldy process. But when people take over the reins of government, and when they control the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch, and in effect have a governmental monopoly, and when the people who have that governmental monopoly operate from a philosophy that says government is bad and we want to prove it to you by killing it, that's where you wind up. Add those dead workers' blood to the blood that drips all over George W. Bush. If there was any karmic justice, everywhere he stepped, his shoes would squish with the workers and the soldiers and the everyday citizens' blood that would just come oozing out over his shoe tops. Because he and Cheney and the rest of that miserable, filthy crowd with their accomplices like Grover Norquist made it happen. "I want to make government so small you can drown it in a bathtub," said Norquist. "If it was up to me, he'd wear headphones 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, with that statement blaring at him at about 150 decibels. And he'd wear them in places like the lower Ninth Ward. And he'd wear them to funerals of working people. and he'd wear them to military funerals and funerals of recently suicided veterans. He'd never take them off until he set up a howl, a miserable scream fit to rend hell itself, and then he'd wear them some more. Because you didn't do this to the government. You fill out your 1040 every year. You send it in. You work for a living, and the money is excised for taxes from your paycheck. You didn't get one of those real sweet tax cut deals that the highest 0.1% of America got under George W. Bush. You didn't get one of those. You keep paying. You make less than $80,000 a year, so naturally every penny you make has Social Security taxation on it. If you make more than $80,000 a year, everything over $80,000 is free, as far as Social Security is concerned. Because our betters have taken care of themselves, and they don't have to worry about what happens to them. They've got the money, so they don't pay. You know, a couple of days ago, the Obama administration announced a letter of understanding between the EPA, the Department of the Interior, and the head of the Army Corps of Engineers, saying that they would more sternly enforce the laws concerning mountaintop removal. Oh, there he goes again. Well, sorry. This is a perfect example. Now, how are they going to have that massive, because it's going to require a massive increase in staffing. How are they going to do that? They inherited a broken government. They inherited a government full of moles. Right-wing moles, graduates of places like Patrick Henry and Liberty and Regents. And no way of knowing where they are. No way of knowing when the next right-wing stick is going to go into the spokes. Fiscal conservatives out there, can we talk? Wouldn't it be much easier, instead of saying we're going to apply a bunch of resources to enforce environmental laws, where the really poisonous practices are concerned, the practices that on which there is absolutely no debate whatsoever, but that the fact that, you know, they're toxic to any human being near them and or downwind and downstream of them, wouldn't it be a lot cheaper just to end the practices? Yes, it would. But that ain't going to happen. The latest screamer. You remember what happened near Kingston, Tennessee last December, right? You remember when John Woffen came on this program and told you his firsthand experiences dealing with the ashbergs bobbing in the Clinch River in the Tennessee from the collapse of the sludge dam at Kingston, Tennessee, and the TVA power plant there. You remember that? Sure you do. Well, that thing blipped, that story sort of blipped onto the radar and blipped back off. Because after all, Chastity Bono is going to have gender reassignment surgery. We can't let things like the poisoning of millions of people get in the way of the for-profit media's need to tell you about somebody's personal gender issues. Because that's news. But you do, because of the of how you are and how we are and what we pay attention to, you know about that. And some people in government have been paying attention to that. Among others, Senator Barbara Boxer has paid attention to that. bless her heart. And when she saw what happened in Kingston, Tennessee, it made her ask a question of herself. Wonder how many more of these there are. Wonder where they are. So Barbara Boxer, being a senator, and senators being used to receiving a certain amount of deference in requests for seemingly innocuous information, Barbara Boxer got out her official senatorial stationery and penned a little note, or picked up the phone, I don't know. And she asked, called a hearing of her Senate committee, and she wanted to discuss these coal ash impoundment sites, these terribly toxic, poisonous nightmares waiting to happen. She wanted to discuss them in a hearing that the American people, so that the American people could then be informed themselves. Senator Boxer behaving in this instance as a representative of the American people, which she, in fact, is, taking a paycheck from the American people, not just Californians. Boy, did she get a letter back. She got told on the double quick that by the Department of Homeland Security, the Obama Department of Homeland Security, that her committee, by God, cannot have a public hearing in which they disclose the location of all the various and sundry poisonous, toxic coal ash dumps across the country. No, senators, screw you and your deference. We ain't telling. Never mind how many millions of people might live near it. Never mind how many millions of Americans might be threatened by it. We ain't telling. Now, why would that be? Come on, everybody. You know the drill, right? Come on. One, two, three. National security. The Department of Homeland Security and the Army Corps of Engineers made a determination that these coal ash dumps, these massive multi-billion pound, multi-billion gallon toxic nightmares, are so poisonous and so toxic and so deadly and so dangerous that the American people can't be told where they are. Because the Tersh might find out. Oh, you knew it was coming. You knew. Come on. Yep, the Tersh might know where the Tersh might find out, and then Osama might want to bomb him a coal ash dump because these things ain't held back by nothing but dirt and rock, and they're manufactured to stand the standard, the construction standards of a 5-year-old. And all he'd have to do is light a wet firecracker around one, and then everything would all cut loose, and everybody'd be screwed. Senator Boxer said, and I quote, "There is a huge muzzle on me and my staff. Homeland Security and the Army Corps have decided in the interests of national security they can't make these sites known." What she does know is that there are several hundred of these monstrosities all across America, and every last one of them is unregulated. Not a single, nothing about how they're lined, nothing about how they're constructed, nothing about how they're inspected, nothing about, nothing. You just kind of have to hope you're not near one. Pray louder, Christian, your God can't hear you. Senator Boxer went on to say, if these coal ash piles were to fail, they'd pose a threat to the people nearby. I believe it is essential to let people know. I think secrecy might lead to inaction. I'm pressing on this. You know, if you're a certain age, you might remember a sitcom on ABC many, many years ago called Welcome Back, Cotter. and Juan Epstein, who was perennially tardy, perpetually absent, and would show up with a note saying, "Dear Mr. Cotter, please excuse Juan's absence as he had leprosy yesterday." Signed, Epstein's mom. It was a running gag, and it was cute. Obviously, I thought it was cute because I remember it all these many years later. Well, welcome to the 21st century version of the national security state. What's that, Senator Boxer? You want to know how many toxic ash dumps there are around the country threatening how many millions of American taxpaying citizens? Sorry, we can't tell you. Sincerely, Epstein's mom. Sorry, we can't tell you because of 9/11. Sincerely, Epstein's mom. Senator Boxer isn't, however, giving up. She has a letter out to the Department of Homeland Security and the Army Corps, and she is asking for a more thorough explanation and a comparison of this policy of secrecy to policies around Superfund-listed sites and nuclear sites. Smart lady. Now, don't you think for a minute that there hasn't been a few phone calls made to the Army Corps and Homeland Security from the massively, unduly, unjustly powerful coal industry saying, "Jesus, don't let them find out! We've been poisoning them for years! They'll sue us out of existence! God Almighty, Don Blankenship will have to find out what a brown bean tastes like! And him living on foie gras like he does! You can't let them... Oh my... Are you crazy?" You think that phone call didn't take place? Oh, sure, it was probably presented in more civil tones. But the underlying urgency and fear was very much there. You see, the lawsuits are piling up on TVA. Ah, it's lawsuit abuse. No, it's not! It's justice! It's going to cost... Outside the lawsuits, it's going to cost more than $1 billion to clean up Kingston. That's a buck a gallon. And by the way, when they clean this crap up, where is it going? Oh, you probably already know. It's going near some poor people's communities. It damn sure ain't going near Senator Rockefeller's little compound in Pocahontas County, I can promise you. It's going to get dumped on some poor folks. Ah, you know, Jesus said the poor you have always with you. A few less won't make any difference. There'll be more poor to replace them, so screw them. So, you know, a little golf clap to Senator Boxer for trying. And a big to Janet Napolitano. For the cover-up. Oh, and by the way, this is the same Army Corps of Engineers that's going to cooperate with Lisa Jackson, Administrator of the EPA, and Ken Salazar, Secretary of the Interior, in enforcing the laws relating to mountaintop removal. You know, SMACRA and NPDES and Clean Water Act. Yeah, this is the same Army Corps that's going to be so cooperative. They won't even... Oh, stop it, Bob. Go to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Preston.
Hey, Preston.
Yeah. You were talking about... Who was it, Frank Luntz?
No. Grover Norquist.
Grover Norquist, that's it. Yeah, but... You know, all this small government rhetoric, it's misleading in some ways because they only want some parts of government to get small. You know, the helpful parts that most of the population wants, like healthcare, you know, park rangers, librarians.
Yeah, meanwhile, they want to pour corporate welfare Miracle-Gro on the Pentagon and the defense industry.
Yep, yep. And it's remarkable to listen to some of these programs where this host will talk about how, you know, government doesn't make jobs. It doesn't do anything like that. Call in. I will listen to you. You know, he intimidates away a lot of his opposition. You know, a lot of people who know better just get frightened away from these discussions. But still, that so many people can sit there in silence when they obviously know that they get their careers from the government. If they're in the military, big government. If they're in ICE, big government. DEA. You have an asphalt job, laying asphalt. Who's buying the roads? Big bad government. And the right wing just goes on and on and on and on and on this complete nonsense. I mean, talk about the big lie. You know, they are lying to themselves.
Well, they want small government, but they don't seem to care about the fact that small government, in a country of this size, small government yields big problems.
You know, they want small government if it's regulating these corporate tyrannies. You know, they want small government if it's studying, you know, toxins in their plastics. They want small government if it's EPA and OSHA and the NLRB. They want huge government when it comes to military, prisons, you know, feeding their various industries.
CIA analysts.
Yeah, NSA, huge. They're always hiring. You know, the prison system, that's a big industry. And actually, today in the Denver Post, there's an ugly story about, well, the headline is, sexual abuse of inmates, distressingly common in state prisons.
Distressingly?
Yeah. At least that we've gotten to the point where we can say it's a problem, and it's a common one, and it's not just Saddam Hussein who had the rape rooms. We've got them. We've got them going on big time. And, you know, we joke about it, sadly enough. Don't bend over for the soap. Hardy har har.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So, yeah, a little success. Within the story, there was a female inmate who was awarded over $1 million because she was sexually assaulted by a prison guard. You know, and there's that whole hierarchy that's created within this sort of industry, you know, where, you know, there are people in power who give the orders, and you obey. Are there going to be hell to pay? Maybe, you know, food issues or solitary confinement. If you're nice to your captor, you know, maybe he'll let you out. And again, it's that same theme that pro wrestling pushes, where you've got the boss man going up to the women, how bad do you want this job? I mean, it's, again, I really can't emphasize enough, Wrestling with Manhood, a documentary. It's kind of expensive, sadly. They're just selling it at the institutional rate, but there are clips of it on YouTube. And again, we see these themes of domination in the video games, and we've spoken a lot about that in the past. But I had a feeling that there was probably some kind of progressive effort in that field of video games going on, and we just hadn't discovered it yet, or at least I hadn't. But I was watching, I was streaming some older episodes of Grit TV, hosted by Laura Flanders, and she spoke with a handful of people who founded and were involved with a group called Games for Change, gamesforchange.org. And they've created these games, including one called ICED with a D, and it's an acronym for I Can End Deportation. And so it's, you know, games that are in solidarity with the human race. And, you know, with people are getting, you know, arrested and jailed and all that stuff. There's another game called Peacemaker. Food Force, where you try to feed, you know, people suffering chronic malnutrition. So, you know, progressive efforts there too. So, anyway, what else? I certainly share your pain about that. That was a great how you described that the security threat posed by these ash dumps. And Hannity,
yeah, it sounds so prosaic, doesn't it? It's just an ash dump.
Yeah, yeah.
They're huge. They're huge.
Yeah, toxic dump would be a better.
Yeah, toxic waste dump. How's that sound?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and again, it's how the right wing can focus our minds and focus the minds of their audience. They co-opt, they seize the notion of security. Security this, security that.
Well, I mean, let's consider just for a minute from a very rational standpoint, Preston. You're a rational guy. I'm rational sometimes. This coal ash contains arsenic. It contains mercury. It contains barium. It contains selenium. It contains, it contains them in concentrations far more vast than in the coal that was burned itself. So how is this not an open toxic? There's the phrase, Preston. Thank you. How is this not, it's not a coal ash dump. I mean, that sounds like, you know, you just take your little clinkers out and you dump them in the backyard. Clinkers are what's left over when you burn coal in a home furnace.
Okay.
It is an open, toxic waste pit. Can we start talking about these things that way? Open, toxic waste pit? Because, see, if Mama hears that her precious Lumpkin is actually living in a house that's 2 miles from an open, toxic waste pit, she's going to respond to that vastly differently than if she hears that her little precious Lumpkin is growing up in a home 2 miles from a coal ash dump.
Yeah. You know, to say nothing of the destruction that's caused just by, you know, the creation of these things, how they just drowned, you know, so how many species of, you know, flowers and bushes, blueberry bushes, and, you know, poison, you know, drowned turtles and salamanders, and, you know, birds probably mistake them sometimes for ponds and land in them and, you know, get asphyxiated.
Yeah, there goes the little duck swimming across the pond, and they take off and ain't got no feet. And it's the, you know, it's the same thing with the description of the fecal ponds and the poison ponds outside of a Smithfield that Smithfield pork processing plant in Mexico.
Yep.
If in the course of working around one of those things, a worker falls in, he is presumed dead, even if they get him out.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that.
It was interesting. I don't know if you ever saw it, but the Simpsons movie had a element of the storyline that was had to do with pig waste, and you know, the pig waste was all piled into a big silo, and Homer accidentally put the pig waste silo into the lake,
right,
and the drinking water, and Homer actually in that same movie. I was a little disappointed in that film. I didn't think it was great, but there were some moments that were pretty good, and some radical moments too, because later, you know, Homer's world's kind of collapsing around him, and he actually has a near-death experience, and then a shaman lady drags him out of the snow and cooks up some tea for him, and he has this kind of dissolution of the ego thing going on. Really interesting. And so I like that. But anyway. Oh, and also, I guess The Simpsons, the program, won some kind of award for a recent episode where, I don't know if it was Homer or another character, befriends a Jordanian character. I think they got some award from a human rights group for their decent portrayal of Arab people, which is so rare.
Especially in light of the fact that The Simpsons has featured the guy working at the Quickie Mart, Apu Nahasapina Petawan.
Okay, and
you know, they're not mean with him, but he is certainly a stereotype.
Well put. It is a stereotype, but it's not cruel, degrading. you know, speaking of people to give thanks for who are doing important work in society and kind of putting themselves at risk at times, you know, we talk about police a lot, and of course the military, you know, if they get shoved off on some corporate mission, they're risking their lives. But I read a statistic where clerks at convenience stores are killed at a higher rate than police officers, much higher actually. You know, they're getting robbed a lot. It's gotten so bad for some that, you know, they've gone behind, you know, bulletproof windows and stuff.
Right. Well, I worked for a summer in a convenience store on the midnight shift, Preston.
Okay.
And the, even back then, in what could arguably have been said to be a more simple time, oh dear, I'm getting all right wing. It was simpler back then.
In some ways it was, but not
but
quite.
You know, one of the, they said, listen, if you get robbed, rule one is give them everything. Give them the cash register. Let them have anything they want to.
Mm-hmm.
Rule two is never leave with them. Don't, if they tell you they'll shoot you if you don't leave, let them shoot you. And for once, it wasn't based on, you know, corporate policy. Well, I guess kind of it was. But the reasoning that was given to me was, if they shoot you here, there's a hope of getting an ambulance to you. But, you know, we're never going to find you if they take you with them.
Yeah.
Do whatever you must to not go with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, and, you know, when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the bar down the street lets out and there's 19 dozen people in there wanting to buy beer from you when beer sales closed at 2. Oh, just do it for me once, man.
Mm-hmm.
It can get a little dodgy. And, yeah, it is. And, of course, it's another example, Preston, of people doing the so-called low-grade, low-pay shit work facing the biggest dangers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that OSHA report that said that, you know, people are dying more because of insufficient inspectors at OSHA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how would you like to be one of the inspectors at OSHA who does have a job there, and you find out somebody died and you go, oh my God.
Yeah.
If only I'd gotten there, we could have. How do you, does a sense of responsibility, does a sense of culpability attach to something like that? Or is it another case of that compartmentalization of the American working mind?
Yeah. And it's that, you know, narrowly focusing, you know, security concerns, you know, oh, God, it's for our security. Got to invest all these billions and billions and billions of dollars in Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and United Technologies to build another M1A1 or whatever. But when it comes to these other, you know, much broader, intimate issues of security, Sean Hannity will never say a word. You know, there are food security issues, you know, all sorts of consumer safety and security issues, workplace.
Look at, well, and that, you know, that's one of the curses of living inside my mind, Preston, is the stuff that I don't forget. And the stuff that I know damned well has not been remedied. Look at that story from a year ago, too, when we found out that America's school children were the ones that were being fed the cattle, fed the meat that came from the downer cattle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You reckon if there had been sufficient inspectors at the USDA that might know, because there's a regulation that says school children can eat downer cattle as long as they're properly cooked. But then again, but then another story comes out and we find out that the green beans are toxic because why? They weren't properly cooked. And the peanut butter is not properly processed. But the meat is okay as long as it's properly, but they're not properly processing. And so sending your kid to school, whether the child is on the free lunch program or pays for the lunch, it's a dice roll. And again, that's another example of how the right wing operates, Preston. They hate the school lunch program, so therefore, the best thing to do is make the school lunch program unsafe.
Yeah.
So that you can then claim, well, you know, we just can't provide a safe school lunch, so we need to end the program.
Yep, set it up to fail. And,
that makes me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, it's, it, It is. It's infuriating. That's no doubt about it. It's sad, too. I mean, that people engage this and, you know, can rationalize it somehow. And, you know, so what if the kids are being fed crap? My kid's okay, and that's the main thing. And
yeah, because you send them to school with a brown bag lunch made out of meat that comes from Smithfield, where they, you know, breed as much flu as they do pork. Yeah, yeah, you feel better because you prepared your kids. Nobody's safe.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You know, although some can afford, you know, some privileges. You know, George Bush, the administration refused all sorts of labeling stuff on organics and, you know, issues regarding genetically modified foods and maybe possibly sugar taxes and all so on and so forth. But for the White House meals, it was specified he wanted organic, non-GMO, healthy food, whole foods, a mix of foods, not, you know, white bread and, yeah, rotting meat and that kind of stuff. Yeah, and you know, the kids, in so many ways, what's going on in the schools, I think, really should be pushed more hard by, you know, progressive media voices. You know, people like Olbermann, I would love to see, and Randy Rhodes talk about all sorts of issues in the schools, because in addition to this nutrition deficit, there's, you know, a lot of kids are being encouraged to be put on Ritalin. Just the whole structure of so many classes and the teaching styles can either be progressive or they can be very authoritarian. Issues of, you know, do they still have playtime? Is there still recess and art and poetry and field trips and stuff like that? Experiential learning. Are we going to have them sitting and worrying about standardized tests all the time? You know, how many books, a lot of progressive books, like probably 30 I can think of, Alfie Cohn and John Taylor Gatto, books like Standardized Tests, Standardized Minds. That is the way we're teaching them. We can create conformist thinking.
And you know, there's so much truth to that, at least to me, Preston. Mm-hmm. Because I see it at work, and this is not a criticism of my children, for I love them dearly. But I try to teach largely by example. I try to teach critical reasoning skills. And I explain why, for instance, if my son said, you know, well, a thing was that way, therefore it could be the other way, and that's an oversimplification, but I took time and I said, no, son, it doesn't work like that. And explained and took time to explain to him why it didn't work. But that's not just the working of a child's mind, that's the way the child's mind has been taught to work through the educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, we are training an entire generation of professional test takers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And frankly, that's when you get out, and anybody who's ever worked for a living, no matter what job they do, I think they would be inclined to agree with me when I say that there just aren't that many jobs out there where it's all multiple choice.
Right.
You know, the life is much more of an essay question than it is true-false.
Yes, indeed.
Ooh, was I profound for a minute there? Wait.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And yeah, you know, I see it in people around me, and I see it in myself sometimes. I think I'll be it's going to be a lifelong process of digging myself out from, you know, patterns of thinking, you know, that weren't the most, mindful and critical, stuff like that. And it's a privilege to come across a speaker like Alfie Cohn. I mean, I think a lot of people in colleges, if they're privileged enough to get to, say, University of Colorado or you know, another school like that, they are provided these voices where they can more aggressively defend themselves intellectually. You know, a lot of people don't have that kind of access. They're, you know, they don't see higher ed or, you know, a community radio station. Those can be very helpful tools, but they're often in college towns, and, you know, more privileged people have access to them. Whereas, you know, a lot of red state communities, they don't have community radio. A lot of them don't even have NPR.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I think there's a risk or a problem sometimes when liberals get some education in some fields, you know. I mean, the so-called uneducated people are the ones who are smart enough to fix the cars and to do all sorts of things, be the carpenters and the plumbers and raise the kids. I mean, there's a huge intelligence going on there.
Yeah, and when I can't get on a D9 Caterpillar and start operating it, all right? I can't. And I was guilty of a certain degree of my own elitism when I talked about these mountain removers who quit school at 16 and take a job blowing up mountains.
Mm-hmm.
That does not for an instant say that they are unintelligent.
Right. Yeah.
But many of these people, oh God.
No, that works. Sometimes these people, is that kind of accurate? So. I won't hold that against you.
Well, but I hold it against me because I don't like groupthink, and I resist group categorization.
Yeah, I'm not sure how else to word that.
I'm not either, Preston. And I am also generalizing about a guy quitting school to take a job on a mountaintop removal site. There are people who make it all the way through high school and take a job on a mountaintop removal site. And I can't get past, well, it's not that I can't get past, it's that I have a fundamental intellectual disconnect with the idea that of someone being so morally and ethically bereft as to think it's okay to destroy entire sections of a state and entire communities and entire families and entire lives for the sake of a paycheck.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that person was given an opportunity to do something else. In other, like, for instance, putting the mountains to rights instead of putting the mountains to wrongs. I wonder if they would do that. You know, we've got the $10 billion that's going to go into carbon capture and storage, the coal corporate welfare that's in the Markey Waxman bill. And I've got a recording that I've got to listen to. But my wife asked a question of them, Markey and Waxman, about the carbon capture and storage giveaway, and the answer was a total piece of misdirectional BS, frankly. Because we all know why the carbon capture and storage stuff is in there. It is to try to ameliorate representatives from coal states. And the fact of the matter is, it's not going to ameliorate them. And that's one of the problems we keep running up against is this notion that we're gonna reach out to the other side and give them something that they are gonna like, even though they're gonna continue to oppose us. But I'm running tangential to my initial point, and that is that $10 billion. You know, none of all these people, to be fair to them, they get up and they go to work every day. Okay, and they are working people. You know, they're my people. They, my kind of people. My people, like I'm the queen of the May. But they're working folks. You know, there's them that works and them that don't. We work, they don't. So they're working people, so they are entitled to a certain degree of my regard for that fact. And they don't, you know, one of the things they always tell you if you confront them is, well, you just want me to go on welfare. No, I want you to find honest work. I want to use the power of government to help create for you honest work. So that $10 billion, $10 billion could put every single mountain remover in West Virginia and probably Kentucky and Virginia too.
Yep.
to work for 10 years.
Yep. And I think therein lies another part of the reason why it's so important for the propagandists to convince us that they're for small government. They want government out of the way because it puts in people's minds, in addition to the deception I was speaking of earlier, it also puts in people's minds that government is bad, doesn't do anything, can't do anything, but get in the way, where in reality, it's the creator of so many economies and industries and jobs and careers. And once we can have that settled, which it is, then we can decide, then questions can arise. What do we want it to create? You know, it's not a hindrance. It's not blocking everything, the free market that they fantasize about. It's us. It is us, the government, you know, in its best moments is us, an expression of what we want. And they know that those desires are just under the surface of all this stuff that they've imposed on us, these systems that they've thrust upon us and, you know, manipulate us into in so many ways. You know, that coal miner doesn't see other sorts of options, and he doesn't have, you know, the recruiters are coming from the military, not from, you know, the Peace Corps. But we could put a bunch of money in the Peace Corps and be constructive people, truly loved around the world as spreading democracy and, you know, assists of all kinds. But instead we're spreading this system around that's so destructive. And again, I mean, the parallel struggles going on in South America over much the same issues, you know, ecosystems being buried, burned down, chopped down, but some really desperate people can get some jobs in it. And then there's the whole propaganda system to back them up. So-called economists, you know, who get private funding to, or, you know, to back it up. So, oh, but, you know, actually there was some success. I don't know if you noticed after the massacre, probably 100 people or so, the indigenous people were shooting back, for sure. There was a militant resistance and several police officers or security. Again, there's that term that they use for themselves. They're security officers. Several were killed. And the population of Peru was really upset, and they protested in the streets. They got a lot of international solidarity going on in the form of emails and calls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
some of the, you know, some of the same going on in the Swat Valley of Pakistan in the tribal regions. I don't know if you've been following that, but a group of in an area that's known for being anti-Taliban, a group of people banded together after the Taliban came and killed one of their leaders. These poor people stood up on their hind legs and said no more, and took to the streets themselves and went and killed them a bunch of Taliban, telling them to stay the hell out and stay out of their lives. Leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I read stories like that and I think, yes, you know, hooray. Because I'm all for people resisting the imposition of religious superstition. But by the same token, I realize I'm reading it on the for-profit media, and I'm wondering, I wonder how we're spinning this. I wonder how many lies this story contains.
Right, I wonder about that too. I mean, I'm sure there are instances where that occurs, but I'm sure there are many instances where people are, you know, I think the Taliban gets caricatured. You know, certainly a lot of them do terrible things, but I think, again, do we really know these people at all? You know, or the Taliban, like the Lakota, maybe? I don't know. And also, look at what they came out of, by the way. I mean, as crazed as they may be, who are they a reflection of, by the way? You know, we don't like how they burn school children. Well, what do you think's been happening with our cluster bombs and our...
Yeah, like there's some sort of moral, there's some sort of moral high ground to burning children if we do it.
Yeah.
And say that we're bringing democracy with the burning babies.
Yeah, it's like, oh my, they poured acid. Oh, acid, yeah, that's horrible, isn't it? What does a fuel air explosive look like, you know? you know, we send out this ball of fire on people. So, yeah, they are kind of crazy sometimes, the Taliban, and I can kind of see why. There's a bigger craziness here in the empire that we don't want to look at. And again, how they focus our minds away from that.
Or if we do dare look at it at all, we want to make sure that we look at it through a lens that is entirely exonerative of anything that we have done, no matter what it is.
Yeah, well, you know, collateral damage in our efforts to do great things, and they're kind of back.
Hey, we invented the term collateral damage. I thought collateral was what you put up when you took out a loan.
Right, right.
And if you think about it in that term, in those terms, it becomes rather horrifying, doesn't it, Preston? We took out a loan on democracy, and our collateral was poor people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, we lost our collateral.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're poor people's lives. They're the sacrifices. Throw them into the volcano, you know, of our industrial economy, you know, so they keep the gods happy. Throw them in.
Yeah, bring me another virgin. And you know, and it's also reflective of a very Western European mindset, as we've talked about before, when the Spanish invaded Central Mexico, and they were so horrified at the concept of human sacrifice, which oddly enough the sacrificial victims were willing to participate in, because they'd been told by their religion industry that it meant straight to the home of the warriors.
And the
Mexica didn't understand why the Spanish were so horrified, because they said, well, you know, we kill people after the war, you kill them during the war.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw this different perspective on those sacrifices in, of all things, a children's book. It was called something like a season for everything, something like that, you know, that line from mm-hmm. the Bible, I think.
And unto everything, it's, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, with each phrase, there'd be a drawing. And there was something about sacrifice or something in there. And then it would do the drawing and the quote. And then there'd be, like, a description of what was going on in this culture. And then they referenced, like, kind of, you know, maybe Mayan or Aztec sacrifice. And they suggested something like, there was also... Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they received propaganda and all kinds of stuff. Maybe there were times where people didn't want to do it.
Well, the Spanish went a long way toward making sure that their account of the horrors of the Indios was, you know, the received wisdom. That there are a lot of people in the nativist community who reject the entire idea that somehow or another all these human sacrifices took place.
Yeah, and that there could be a willingness to it at times where people just, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, has a book, something about no fear, no death, or something like that. He is talking about continuity of life, you know, and sort of thing. You know, Ram Dass, he's studied a lot of the Hindu stuff, and they also have this very different concept of our physical being versus what they think is more permanent, which is our spiritual or soul kind of stuff, and that they're more aligned with that, so that to make this physical sacrifices, you know, it's okay. In fact, in some ways we do it here in this culture, I think. You know, someone like a Martin Luther King knew what was going to happen to him, and he chose it. Again, the soul power. So, Judy Berry. Talk about a person who could really, you know, bridge that gap between how do you deal with the workers of a destructive industry and their economic concerns, versus trying to save the environment. And she bridged that gap, you know, and she talked to the lumber workers, the timber people, and she was like, look, they're so exploiting nature that they're exploiting you out of a job as well. And, you know, they're cutting down workers, like they're cutting down these trees, you know, making, you know, the workloads bigger, fewer workers, less pay, and you know, what you need to have a job is being harvested totally unsustainably. So she, you know, did a lot of really successful organizing and got all kinds of grief from all sides on that, and including her car blowing up under very suspicious circumstances. In fact, her family won a lawsuit against, I think it was the FBI, for their involvement in that incident, and won a bunch of money. You know, Judy Berry made a sacrifice, and just a remarkable person. It's sad, the only book on her is kind of a hit piece on her, a very subtle hit piece. You know, if you're to look at the cover and the title and some of the stuff inside, it seems kind of sympathetic, but it's not when you dig deeper into it. You know, another person who was doing risky work, Julia Butterfly Hill. And, you know, she was up and doing that tree sit, historic tree sit, I might add, for over a year. She got international press, certainly all kinds of, you know, woke a lot of people up here in this country. And, but, you know, she'd have timber guys down below starting up their chainsaws. But she endured and she converted a lot of those timber guys. A few of them fell in love with her, actually. And one of them climbed up in the tree with her for a while, and she, you know, she continues her good work. So, but you know, people can sacrifice. You know, it's not always a physical thing; it can be time. You know, and you know, I think a lot of people avoid political work because they feel it will make them sad and frustrated and change them, kind of. And some of that stuff might be true. Certainly, if you're not in a good community of support, and just if you're reading a lot of this dreary news about the environment and labor and foreign policies, it can get depressing. So, but again, to put ourselves out there emotionally, physically, financially, you know, that's a sacrifice we can choose to make or not. But usually, also, it's not so much sacrifice, it's enriching our lives, you know, to kind of, you know, again, try to live our values. Try to listen to what our moms taught us about respecting others and cleaning up our messes. And, you know, trying to, or if we're into religion, trying to be good Christians, loving our neighbors, caring for creation. And again, back to the fun part of activism, people like Alice Waters, she's a chef.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, we're talking about standardized tests and Ritalin and all that crap going on in so many of the schools, but here she is doing something totally radical, starting this edible schoolyard movement, which I could only read about in little journals like Yes Magazine in the past, but I was so pleased about a month or two
ago. Yeah, because God forbid that, yeah. Oh, it showed up in the for-profit media, did it?
It was on 60 Minutes. Yeah. And, I know when I punch in edible schoolyards these days on the Google search or something, it's all over the place. So it's fun to see. And the kids are healthier for it and happier, and they're learning a lot. You know, they're learning about gardening and harvesting. Sometimes here in Denver, actually, we had one of those develop, and the kids, they had so much food, they had more than they could eat. They had a little farmer's market going. And, you know, so then the neighbor people would come by and have a lot of fun with that. And then this group of immigrants from, like, I think the Sudan, they came by and they helped the kids with some of their gardening stuff and took part in the farmer's market. I mean, it was beautiful. And so, again, we can get lost in the pit of so much to despair about, but there's always these stories, though, to, you know, keep us afloat.
Oh, sure. Every time I've been to any sort of activism, no matter how serious the nature of it, there was always a lot of laughter, a lot of camaraderie, a lot of joy in the company. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's one thing that we have going for us. because we are not doer, and we do understand that you have to laugh along the way.
Yeah, and there's a huge effort to undercut that camaraderie, to undercut solidarity in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a whole other level of propaganda coming at us beyond the political misinformation. There's a whole attitudinal massaging that's going on of our minds. A lot of cynicism and competition and backbiting that's encouraged in many ways. Sometimes they're flat-out infiltrators. Sometimes they've got people working the press, and they'll do reviews of books to try to, undercut, something that might enthuse the rabble. But still, we roll along and, trying to make the best of it. And it's fun to see what that produces sometimes. Actually, I was thinking about Al Gore lately. A friend of mine, an activist, talked about how he apparently has some investments in something to do with carbon credit stuff, and how that whole system's going to be arranged to, deal carbon credits and try to cut down on CO2 emissions.
Sure.
I've heard that. I haven't really looked into it, though, so I don't know how true it is. I just thought it was interesting. And, I'd prefer that. If it is true, I'd prefer that sort of business to what he was doing before, which was, he had some investments in Occidental Petroleum, which had a lot going on in Colombia and the Uwa indigenous people, and so he was getting heat, deservedly so, for that. Now he's getting heat for this kind of thing. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder, I don't know, I need to look more into that particular story and be careful of it. I see a lot of kind of Alex Jones's work being very dismissive of climate concerns. And that makes me very suspicious of Alex Jones.
Oh, I'm so done with Alex Jones.
Okay. Every now and again he'll interview Kucinich, and that's good. But boy, there are some other things about.
Yeah, but there's just too much hucksterism surrounding him. And there just is, and it's too much grand scheme stuff for me to swallow at a bite. And I just can't. It's funny. Last night I had a bit of a frog in my throat, and Gary from Maryland called up and said, "You doing your Alex Jones impression?" And somebody else said, "Yeah, it does kind of sound that way." But and I think one of my objections with the people, and I don't use the phrase conspiracy theory anymore, because conspiracies are real. And for my own personal comfort, I have changed that. I use a phrase instead: grand scheme.
Yeah, that's better.
Because conspiracies are real. Conspiracies happen all the time. There are massive conspiracies inside, for instance, the oil, coal, gas industry to make sure that we don't take positive steps toward becoming not foreign oil independent, but carbon independent. One of those conspiracies took place in the drafting and the committee efforts around Marky Waxman, because it was a conspiracy to make sure that there was $10 billion worth of the corporate coal welfare. That was a conspiracy. Okay, they're real.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there are the grand schemes, things that ask you to believe something impossible in order to reach a greater philosophical truth that is being advanced by someone, usually in the interest of making money. And that's what I reject. I do not have any sense of the complete nature of what happened on September the 11th. I know that because the Bush administration dummied up the 9/11 commission, that report is so flawed as to be specious.
Yeah.
But I am not willing to take the next step and say, pick out anything that the truthers say. I can't do that because it offends my rational mind.
Yeah, and I'll be myself. I'll entertain the idea. I'll hear it out. I'll look into it, and I'll say, well, that's interesting too, to some of the stuff for sure. But again, thinking critically about this stuff, you know, I mean that is always suggested as the truth is unhealthy style of thinking. This is the truth, and I'm a truther. Unhealthy. Again, it cuts off critical thought. There are other truths to consider, you know, like truths of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and potential blowback issues. So if you call it an inside job, you're kind of forgetting about blowback, which is a serious issue, a security issue, a commentary on our foreign policy, which I think gets lost in some of the truther discussion. There's the missing history when Arab people, I think in the 70s, hijacked 3 or 4 planes simultaneously. They didn't fly them into buildings, but they hijacked them and landed one in Jordan and and other, I think, in Egypt, and they're making a statement about the occupation, Israeli occupation of the territories. So this isn't so far, and I'm sure Israel had very tight security back then, and how is it that they could have let this happen? Well, it happened. They did it. And they did it, and they probably did it here. That's what it looks like.
But there was no money to be made in Israel by a movement that claimed that it was really the Israeli government who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So there was no Arab hijacking truth movement in Israel.
And one of the huge problems of this truth movement, so-called, that I see, is how it's causing divisions in the left.
And
And this is what I mean about that attitudinal work going on to divide us, to chop down solidarity, camaraderie, to break that away. And this has been a perfect topic to do that. I know people personally who've been attacked for not buying into this. And you know, progressive thinker.
Every time this comes up, I get a nasty email asking me how I could be so blind.
Yep. So people like you aren't getting the support that you deserve. People like Amy Goodman, she's been jacketed, labeled as a gatekeeper.
Oh, well, yeah, you remember when Bill Maher, he gets the support he deserves. Remember when Bill Maher got screamed at by some idiot truther in the audience?
I missed that, but yeah, that's standard operating procedure.
And you know, my whole reason is, you know, I'm a student of history. But at the same time, you have to have some sort of a valid history and not speculation in order to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument that I've made time and time again, and I believe it is a valid argument, is that with all the energy that we have spent looking backwards at September the 11th, 2001, we have made it more likely that there will be another one.
Yep.
It's not going to be planes into buildings this time. It's going to be something entirely different. And it will probably be a function of blowback, as you describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as we're looking over our shoulder, you know, how many cartoons have you seen where the guy's looking over his shoulder and runs into a lamppost? And it's really funny when it happens into the cartoon, but it's not funny when it happens into reality. And that's what we're doing. Oh, looking over his shoulder. Oh, my God. Oh, whack! And, you know, upside the head.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, when it hurt, I can't count the number of times that here and there I've, had a cabinet door open above me and forgotten about it and bent down to get something and raised my head up right into the corner of the cabinet.
Oh,
yeah, I do some really, really profoundly talented swearing when that happens. And it really, really hurts. And it's all because my focus was somewhere else. And I hurt, and because my focus was on something, rather than looking forward and doing whatever it was I opened the cabinet door for, I got hurt. Well, it's the same thing on a social or national scale. If our focus is on something that is now fairly distantly in the past, and that is not to diminish the horrors of it, But if we're sitting here worrying about, you know, whether there was thermite in Building 7 or whatever the latest is, then when something entirely different comes along, we're screwed.
Yep.
We'll not be ready for it.
It's taken up a huge amount of people's just kind of intellectual energy, their activist energy, you know, that they're communicating so narrowly on this issue. It's almost like you're ignored if you're not here because they claim this is it. This is the most important thing, da-da-da-da-da. There are a lot of important things, you know. And, just recently I came across a new Howard Zinn book. It's like a reissue of a book on history involving children and their important role in U.S. history and in creating a more progressive society. In fact, it was a 15-year-old girl who, a couple months before Rosa Parks, sat down on the bus and refused to move and spent a day in jail for it. That she, you know, just a confluence of things make Rosa Parks known to us, which is great. But this young woman, I think something Colvin, like Seanette Colvin, something like Claudette Colvin, I think. So there's a Zinn book, and I'm looking at what people wrote about it, and most of them were 4 stars or 5 stars out of 5, very positive. Somebody wrote a 1-star review, and it said something to the effect, "Ever since I learned that Howard Zinn refuses to, or isn't calling for a new investigation into 9/11, I'm not going to read this person. I don't care how renowned he is. Blah, 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 blah." I mean, it's just so emotionally unintelligent, emotionally reactive, right-wing.
And is it paranoid to ask who it is and why it is that those profound emotional reactions are being ginned up, Preston?
Yeah, I wondered if this one was a professional sort of, you know, BSer to try to cultivate that kind of sentiment. Again, someone might read that, and if they're not thinking critically, they'll be like, you know, and it might get absorbed to some level.
Oh, there's that phrase again, that critical thinking.
Yep. Or if this was a really kind of organic, you know, a person out there who's gotten swept up into that truth or movement and really does resent Zinn on their own volition, whatever, you know, and to just wipe aside, you know, fine, you have your concern and all that about 9/11, but to just brush aside Zinn's critically important work on all those other people's stories is just dumb.
You know, it is a rare occasion when I hear Preston refer to something as dumb.
I know, and I should probably rephrase that. Probably
No. But just like me and these people, sometimes the situation and not your vocabulary is what limits the word choice.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes the way words have been misused in the past, they can become problematic. But when they're actually useful. Actually, terms like, retarded, you know, has become this kind of, you know, applied to a particular, you know, person with developmental disabilities, for instance.
Right, and then it works its way into the general argot, as in, stop being so retarded.
Yeah, and kind of a, you know, kind of an ugly way to use it, but it's also a very useful term, and, you know, I think right-wing radio has retarded people's thinking.
Right, because the original meaning, you know, anybody who plays music and can read music knows that every now and then you'll see on sheet music RIT period. And that means retard. And of course it's the language of music is Italian. And that means to slow. And that's all the word originally meant was slow. Or slow as compared to the pace of everything else. Slow.
Okay. I'm looking at dumb right now in the dictionary. I inherited my mom's dictionary. One of the synonyms for it is foolish. And yeah, to wipe aside the sort of work that Zinn does because he allegedly doesn't support another investigation is foolish. And, you know, and another thing that's kind of a sad irony about Zinn being now condemned for this, he first, I don't know if that's true. If he probably does it support another investigation, but putting that aside, he actually blurbed David Ray Griffith's book.
Did he really? Like,
yeah, yeah, but that's not enough. It's got to be, you got to be totally pure or something all the time. All, you know, you can't utter a thing critical or something. You got to do more. What'd you do lately? And if you haven't done it, hell with you. 1-star review for you. And so, yeah, that truth movement is problematic in so many ways. Oh, and speaking of words that have been kind of misconstrued or maybe, you know, lost some of their utility, compete. The word compete actually comes from a Latin word meaning to strive together.
Yes.
And conspiracies, actually, you know, they're always a negative thing, but there could be positive, progressive conspiracies.
Well, but conspiracy, unless I've got my Latin completely backwards, comes from spero, which is hope, to hope with, to hope together.
Oh, boy. See, they don't want us thinking about that kind of concept.
No.
They want us hopeless together. That's what they've been working on for a while. And, you know, if people are hopeless.
Oh, but you know what? The truth, you got to, I'm just informed of something by Ben Birch, and he keeps a close eye on some of this because he's got the engineering and the brains background to put paid to a lot of the stuff that comes from the truther movement. But, you know, little golf clap to the truther movement. Apparently they're suing Glenn Beck for defamation.
You know, and there are moments when...
But downside to that, maybe they'll sue me, too. I don't know.
You know, in moments, I like what that movement's up to. You know, I don't completely dismiss it.
I'm down with challenging the status quo.
Yeah, yeah.
But I draw the line when it begins to look like a religious faith.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are and just for me, you know, and that's, you know, this whole thing got started with the mention of Alex Jones. Alex Jones is far more reminiscent for me. He resembles a Kenneth Copeland or a Creflo Dollar a lot more than he resembles a journalist. He resembles, you know, because
yeah.
or maybe the better comparison would be Pat Robertson, because Pat Robertson has this humongous phony news organization, Christian Broadcasting News.
Yeah.
That purports to be real news when in fact it's nothing but a propaganda arm for his religion industry money making operation, and that's, you know, that's one of the things. I'm probably pissing people off all over creation, but that's one of the things that bugs me about Alex Jones, is he resembles, and I've tried to come to a conclusion or some sort of comparison. It's Pat Robertson. Alex Jones is some sort of grand scheme version of Pat Robertson, and he has created a religion around it, and he is its grand apostle.
Well,
but by the same token, I realize I'm pissing people off right now, and all I can say to that is, I am as agnostic to what happened on September the 11th, 2001, as I am about the existence of some form of deity.
Yeah, and it will never be solved. I mean, that's another thing that makes it kind of perfect for, you know, just keep having left-wing people or progressive people pouring money and time and energy into it.
Yeah, well, you know, I go over, Preston, I go over and I read Alternet from time to time.
Me too.
And I called them, not in some sort of public thing. Well, yeah, public insofar as it was a response to a blog post. But anytime there's a 9/11 thing up there, it gets, and this is another one of those things, it gets bajillions of hits. Okay? Twice, they put up articles, and it was their lead article in their little blast email that, you know, to let you know what's on Alternet that day. And I went over there, and they were sort of puff pieces. But then underneath it, I saw this just torrential river of, you know, Screw you, alternate. You're a gatekeeper. You know, all the words.
Yep.
And down at the bottom, wherever it was in the thread, I finally wrote, you know, shame on alternate. Because I've come to the conclusion that every couple of weeks, when they want to drive their views up, when they want to drive their traffic up, they've learned that all they have to do is throw something about 9/11 in their blast email, and they'll generate massive amounts of traffic. And that's one of the reasons that I stay away from it, because regardless of what my personal feelings are about it, I'm not going to leverage the horror that was that day as a means of generating either audience for this network or financial support for this network. One of the reasons that we stay dirt poor, one of the reasons that you know, we're sitting here sweating, making it through July, is because we will not subvert the mission of the horn, Preston, to some form of hucksterism. You know, I'm very, very sensitive about saying who has supported and how much.
Mm-hmm.
Because for every person that I thank or everybody who I personally name, there's somebody out there who's feeling bad about it because they didn't or couldn't. And yeah. I am not going to leverage that. I mean, I know how to do it, but I won't do that any more than I will do an altar call or 9/11 truth or any number of grand schemes, even though it would probably mean a significant uptick in listenership. And frankly, a significant uptick in support. I mean, David Ray Griffin, is that who it was?
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, Alex Jones and some of these other people have become very, very well off by leveraging the pocketbooks of people who are frustrated with what happened on that horrible, horrible day.
Yeah.
And I find that to be well past shameful, Preston. And I can't do it. And maybe that means we won't survive. But if we don't survive, let no one say that we failed financially because we tried to leverage people's emotional attachments to highly controversial topics. You know, if you ever see the logo of the Head On Radio Network where it says Head On Radio Network, on is in all caps. You know, it's a play on the word of a head-on collision, but it's also a reflection of what right-wing radio and what grand scheme radio and religious radio aren't. And that is that we do all of this with our head firmly affixed to our shoulders. And we do not abandon reason, and we do not abandon logic, and we do not abandon common sense for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that was not, that didn't mean to, I didn't, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and you don't abandon your audience, and I hope it continues to be there for you. I didn't send money recently, but I did send out a little, I posted Head On's link on my Facebook wall again, and, you know, doing a little informal marketing, I guess you could say.
And that's how we'll build it.
I think there's a huge potential in, you know, just little steps like that. So often we're, you know, did you write your rep and sign petitions? And sometimes we wonder how effective they are. And I think they're important, and it's, you know, a task to do. But these other sorts of, I think, routine tasks, like links to message boards and, renting a progressive film or making sure it's in your library, you know, that's another thing. People can't afford, you know, if you don't have money to invest in causes, you can go to your library and make suggestions. Oftentimes they'll listen to patrons. Just where we're putting our money is such a huge you know, what magazines we have coming in our mailboxes, what magazines are sitting in our dentist's office. You know, so many ways in which we can sort of become media agents ourselves. But a couple quick things before I let you go. You may have someone else on the line or not. I don't know. But conspire. Back to my mom's dictionary. It could be either to join in a secret agreement to do an unlawful or wrongful act, or to use such means to accomplish a lawful end. And the other definition of it is to act in harmony, which isn't so bad. We have moments of, and there's a conspiracy of putting aside the oil industry and the coal industry, the fossil fuel mafia conspiracy. There are people in green energy conspiring, and I was reading on commondreams.org, June 4th article they found from The Guardian titled, Green Energy Overtakes Fossil Fuel Investment, says UN. I was really surprised to hear that. For the first time this year, wind, solar, and other clean technologies attracted $140 billion compared to $110 for gas and coal for electrical power generation, with more than a third of the green cash destined for Britain and the rest of Europe. But certainly a lot here, a lot going on in China. Again, there's just a little nugget of information. Put it out there, really undercuts that message that it's not realistic, it's so small, it'll never provide enough, da-da-da-da-da. While they're saying that, here's the reality. Get passed up. And it's kind of fun to see. And somebody on Facebook has been putting up quotations. A couple people have, actually. And I came across this one I liked a lot. From Herman Melville. Wrote Moby Dick, right?
Right.
Yeah, he put, he said...
Bartleby the Scrivener, yeah.
Okay. And I think of this when I hear immigrants getting bashed and welfare mothers getting bashed. And people living in the Amazon jungle getting bashed. He said, of all the preposterous assumptions of humanity, nothing exceeds the criticisms made of the habits of the poor by the well-housed, well-armed, and well-fed. Herman Melville.
Beautiful.
I like that.
And, you know, I mentioned Bartleby the Scrivener. If you've never read that, it's a short story, perhaps a novella.
I haven't heard of that, actually.
You would do well to do so. Because for when it was written, it is a classic tome of passive resistance. And I remember the first time, I think it was high school when I first read it, and it was kind of life-changing. And I'm sure it's online, so just, you know, in your idle moments, perhaps this weekend, take a couple of hours, maybe an hour, whatever it takes, and read Bartleby the Scrivener. And report back your thoughts, because I have a feeling it's going to have a profound impact on you.
Okay. So oftentimes we're not familiar with some of the more powerful stuff. Bartleby the Scrivener. Okay.
B A R T L E B Y the Scrivener. S C R I V E N E R.
Okay. Oh, and. I also have an issue of the Denver Post here that I've been hanging on for a few weeks, but I like the article so much, I wanted to share part of it with you. And it very much has to do, how is it that green energy investment has possibly surpassed gas and coal for electricity generation? Well, and this was actually like the day after I had said something very dismissive of the Denver Post. And like the next morning, I come across this article as if, you know, catching myself there, I was like, well, I wasn't being fair to the Denver Post. This article entitled In Step with a Green Vibe, DPS, that's the Denver Public Schools and other districts, are working to save energy, cut waste, and boost recycling. And they quote somebody about how there's a building momentum in the whole green movement in the district. Everything is coming back to how it can enhance learning. And they talk about a new $48 million school campus planned for Green Valley Ranch at the school. We'll have solar panels and geothermal heating and cooling in an attempt to become the nation's most energy efficient school. And it just goes, and this article just goes on like that with these schools. Again, government. This is the government they hate, where people can have some community power over what kind of investments are being made. That's why they want to privatize everything, so it's a group of executives sitting behind closed doors to burn their product.
Naturally.
But we still have these institutions where we do have some popular control. And so there's this wonderful article, and along with the article is this accompanying photo with all these beautiful kids in a circle holding hands with their teachers. And in the middle is a young, looks like a Vietnamese American kid with a gourd that he's shaking. It says, Bo Nguyen 8 plays a gourd rattle while his Ellis Elementary schoolmates practice a sun circle dance on Tuesday. The students were to perform at the dedication of the school's solar panels. And
now, see, us being liberals and all, we go, isn't that cool? That's sweet. That's nice. Meanwhile, there are just fear-sodden right-wingers who would read a story like that. Here goes Bob setting up a straw man. I know when I'm doing it, and I'm bad for doing it. But I know how right-wingers think. What's that got to do with the learning experience? That kid ain't going to know nothing more about algebra from doing no damn sun circle ceremony. That's pagan religion and taking him away from his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. They're trying to enforce paganism in our schools.
You nailed it. That's exactly what they're saying.
And you're kidding.
There's that. There's there's the fossil fuel industry PR firms. Those people working for that stuff, they see something like this, and they just go, they probably send out some emails, send some packages, maybe get someone to lobby the post.
Put a horse's bed in the horse's head in the teacher's bed. Yeah, sure.
Right. Yeah, there's probably those people out there seeing this thing about public schools and going grumbling about those dreaded unions.
No wonder our kids is number 932nd to the Japanese and mathematics sun ceremony. And oh my God. You know it. Hey, Preston, I got to roll along, brother. Thanks for a wonderful conversation.
Likewise, Bob.
Have a great weekend. Tell me what you think of Bartleby.
I'll do that.
All right. Bye. Now, if you've never read Bartleby the Scrivener, if you've got any interest in nonviolent resistance, you might find that tale interesting. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. This is Richard.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Oh, okay. Hanging in there. The subject on my mind right now is Max Baucus.
He makes me a little crazy.
Yeah.
No, he makes me a lot crazy. Who am I? I ain't gonna lie.
Really. I think that we need to go on the attack against people like this and just get them the hell out of our government. There is simply the issue of corruption, and I think probably at the bottom of all the 8 years of our hell with Bush, corruption was at the core of it. What do you think?
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, corruption and that ideological, I guess it's a subset of corruption if you want to think of it in terms of a Venn diagram, but that ideological drive to destroy government. Because if you can just kill government, money and business can run roughshod, can run riot through the nation.
Really. Single-payer health care is very dear to me, the concept. And, I've been working at the edges of this for quite some time. I'm a health care commissioner in my county. And also, I've mentioned this before, and I'll say it again, Contra Costa County in California started the America's first government-run HMO about 30 years ago. And we're the poster child in any ways for how to do it right. And it's not without its problems.
What human institution is?
Yeah, you know what's the thing that troubles me is that it has to be a halfway measure. In other words, we're an HMO. Well, we have to be governed by the regulators in exactly the same way that the private guys are. And so this, I use a terrible phrase here. It's like we have to provide health care with one hand tied behind our back. You know?
Well, it is, and Lord, it's so frustrating. It makes you want to scream, Richard. It really does.
Yes, it does.
Because this is, you know, this is one of those cases where anybody with any scientific training understands that the simplest solutions are most frequently the most elegant and the most workable. And so instead of building this giant Rube Goldberg device that involves silk-suited corporate executives profiting off the agony, misery, illness, and death of American people, why not just go to single payer and fix it?
Oh, yes.
Because there's money to be made, and the answer is because there's money to be made inside the Rube Goldberg device. Because the Rube Goldberg device is big enough and complex enough that there's all kinds of money that falls out of the pipes all along the way.
There really is. I mean, again, it's, God, I don't want to focus on the problem so much as to focus on what do we do. And I don't have an answer, you know. I don't have that answer because it's so complex. I go to commission meetings every 2 months, and it's like the statistics are just overwhelming to try to absorb the whole dog and pony show that that staff presents to us. And yet it's got to be done. The stuff has to be looked at. And this year, we actually became the second cheapest HMO in the whole Bay Area, and for the first time that I've been involved with it. So Kaiser beat us on premiums, and this is like the first time. We don't have Kaiser's economy of scale. We've got about 20 or 22,000 members in the county, whereas Kaiser is nationwide and very big. So Kaiser, for instance, operates its own pharmacies and buys prescription drugs themselves, and they get good deals on them. They, you know, buy in bulk. We, on the other hand, closed our three pharmacies because of the budget cuts that were required. And we're here in California.
Right.
So I was sad to see our pharmacists leave. I found them to be a good resource, but you see, we don't have that economy of scale. Our prescriptions got farmed out to Walgreens, as a matter of fact.
Oh, jeez.
Well, it was. I almost understand why it had to be done. The thing was that we're an agency of the county. The county is a unit of the state. So the state comes to the county and says, you got to cut your health care budget by $8 million. And all the department heads go crazy, you know, trying to find places to trim services. Nothing else to trim. So we have, for instance, a psychiatrist, half-time psychiatrist assigned to the juvenile prison. Actually, I think it was the juvenile holding tank, and they just let him go so the kids don't get anything.
And what you're looking at in those, because frankly, Richard, I hope you won't disagree with me when I say that it should not be the function of a public health care plan to provide psychiatric and psychological services to a juvenile detention facility.
Oh yeah. Well, you see, it's
and what you're seeing there is the Republican created failure of government.
Oh yes, definitely. But this thing has so many tentacles and so many different facets to it.
Oh sure, but if some kid is standing in juvenile court, there is language something akin probably to the judge looking at him and saying, I commit you to the care, custody, and control of the California Department of Corrections, therein to be kept and treated, yada, yada, yada. And the important words are care, custody, and control.
Yeah.
At that point, the state of California has taken absolute, unmitigated ownership of the well-being of that child.
Yeah. Well, let's back up.
And that includes mental health.
Yep. Let's back up for a moment. So I'll tell you about the structure of this thing. You see, it's the county health... I wasn't clear. It's the county health department that had that responsibility for the county jail. What we've got is the county health department, like anybody else's county health department, it's the health service of last resort, and it's used by the poorest people in general. And we, you know, like everybody else, we had such an operation. And then somebody got a bright idea. They said, why don't we see if we can offer our Medi-Cal population something better than they get already? Now, at that point, there was just fee-for-service Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal meaning...
Medicaid California.
Exactly. So they set this thing up. They started an HMO, and people could buy into it. Buying into it simply means that the state signs over, Joe Blow's Medi-Cal coverage directly to Contra Costa County, to the HMO. And the HMO now provides all services to this person. And again, it's like you get economy of scale. How can we do it better? And it worked. It worked really well. So after that, they said, they thought, I wonder if we can do this for our county employees. So then they offered it to the county employees for a penny a month. So the county employee could choose Blue Cross Blue Shield. They could choose, Kaiser. They could choose us.
Right.
Went over big. Worked. And then, finally, they decided to offer it to the general public at large and to employers, the same way other HMOs work. And that's where I came in. See, I came in as somebody who bought the health plan over the counter, and it became my own health coverage of choice. And I've been pretty happy with it for most of the years, until my premium doubled and tripled. And I was paying $1,000 a month for health care between myself and my son. So we're talking big money here.
Yeah, you're spending some real dollars there.
Yeah, I mean, it went from 200-something to 1,000. And this is including all costs, prescriptions, doctor visits, which tripled, from $5 to $15. And so I got real upset, obviously, and I started digging around, what is the reason for all this? And the answer I got was that they had hired on an actuary and discovered that we had a high proportion of very sick people, and that ran the costs up. Now, I'm not sure I believe that totally, but, that's what came down.
That's the excuse that's given.
Well, that's, I'm going to the people who...
Well, I mean, is it not to be...
That's their own people who are giving me the answers.
Right, I understand that, but the question... Oh, dear. Richard, we're out of time.
Oh, okay.
let's pick this up sometime next week, because this is real-world stuff that has to be considered.
Okay, anyway, let's all, everybody, think about how to dump Bacchus. We got to punish people who do this to us.
I think you're right.
We've got to really get on.
Well, obviously, okay. Obviously, we've got to... my preference would be to find a real liberal Democrat to run against him in the primary in Montana.
Yes, exactly. Okay,
because getting a worse Republican is no answer.
Exactly. Agreed.
Okay. All right. Take care, Richard.
Right. Bye.
Bye now. Well, we're almost done. It's the end of the program, and by the time we are back with you on Monday, it will be the middle of June. It will be a middle of June that is making it more and more unlikely that there will be a middle of July. Not a joke. We are scrambling. I'm doing everything I can. And hopefully we will uncover some funding sources that will give us a little bit of breathing space. But it remains dire. That's all I can say. With all respect to the people who cannot, if you can make use of the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, you will be making certain that there's a July for the horn. It's that simple. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, to the moderators in the chat room, ELO, Lottie. Lottie's also the forum moderator. Use the forum, by the way. Make use of it. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to all of you who contribute every way that you do. Ideas, emails, phone calls, chat room, forum, blog. Thank you. You validate the theory that underpins all of this. Have a wonderful weekend. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.